I'm Chris Williamson. I'm the deputy leader of the Workers' Party. It was founded in 2019. We had a success, obviously, in the Rochdale by-election. We've seen a big surge of members into the Workers' Party now. But we are still a relatively small acorn. It's run by entirely by volunteers. And we have a 10-point plan. And it's a very, I mean, the very first one actually talks about opposition to war and NATO, which is particularly relevant at the moment. But it's also a very clear commitment to decent housing, education, free access to education from the cradle to the grave, a proper industrial strategy, you know, creating decent jobs for people and employment rights, etc. I mean, I guess I could sum it up by as common sense socialism, the sort of policy agenda that the Labour Party used to believe in. I mean, if you go back to 1974, there was a manifesto commitment to bring about an irreversible shift in the balance of wealth and power in favour of working people and their families. But that was effectively abandoned. Well, not effectively, it was abandoned in 1976 when Denis Healy went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise, i.e. that Britain was running out of money, which is impossible when you issue your own currency. And we'd been in a floating fiat currency since 1971, which was no longer linked to the dollar, which was linked to gold. That was abandoned by Richard Nixon. And you know, we've obviously since that time had a huge amount of flexibility, which has never really been embraced by political leaders, only when we want to fight wars. And as Tony Benn used to say,
well, look, listen, this term fiat currency, I'm sure quite a lot of listeners won't be familiar with it. Well, what is this? I mean, fiat, we know what that is. It's an Italian car. But what's a fiat currency?
Well, essentially, it's just a currency which is not backed by any kind of commodity like gold or anything like that. And it's essentially a currency that the value of which is based upon, you know, the commitment and belief that, you know, the government will honour the value of the currency, as it were. So in the old days, you know, you were limited into as to how much you could spend by virtue of your gold reserves. And that was a real limiting factor on the ability of governments. We had fixed exchange rates and things like that back in the old days. It's been a lot more flexible ever since. But as I say, the point I'm making is that no government has really embraced the opportunities that gives them.
The reason why is because what we keep hearing is that if you decide you want to just print money and start spending it into the economy as a government, then you're going to just cause runaway inflation.
Yeah, that's the scare tactics which are often used. And, you know, it's not about saying you can just spend the money at will. You have to match it to the ability of the economy to absorb that spend. In other words, there has to be the availability of real resources for sale in that particular currency, that are available for purchase, as it were, by the public sector, by the government. And if there is a competition, if the economy is you're heating up and you've got a big public sector program and you're competing for resources, whether it be labor or raw materials with the private sector, then that, if you could just continue spending in those circumstances, you know, yes, of course you will create inflation. But so long as you kind of limit it to the availability of those real resources, and indeed when you get to a point where the economy is starting to overheat and inflationary pressures are emerging, you can use the tax system. And indeed, that's really what the tax system, one of the main reasons for the taxes, or should be anyway, to limit inflationary pressures. You could use those tax intervention to close off the ability of the private sector to compete for the same resources that you want to spend, you know, as a public priority, as it were.
Anyway, look, every time I see Jeremy Hunt, it's a terribly biased thing to say, but my heart sinks. Everything he seems to be involved in, for example, the top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service, the control of our press regulation, which led to massive mergers of independent radio stations around the country, which meant that there aren't really any independent local radio stations anymore, for example. But anyway, he's done his budget this week. One of the main headlines from it has been this 2% reduction in national insurance. Now, can you just say what national insurance, you know, what you make of this attempt to cut national insurance? Because a lot of people are happy and seeing this as a tax cut.
Yeah, I mean, I guess those that benefit from it will be happy, but, you know, a lot of people won't benefit from it. People that don't pay national insurance, for example, who are low paid, they don't pay national insurance, you know, below a particular threshold. And indeed, people, you know, older citizens don't pay national insurance either. So it will be limited in its scope, in its benefit to people. But obviously what's not happened is which is usually the case in a budget, the tax threshold, in other words, the amount of income you're allowed to earn before you start to pay tax, is usually increased, at least with the inflation. And that's not happened this time. And the tax cut that's been made has been focused on national insurance. And so its effect will not be as wide ranging as an increase in the tax threshold. And so what some commentators have said, and I've not done the number crunching myself, is that, the effect, the benefit is pretty neutral for those people who are benefiting from the 2% reduction. If there'd been an increase in the tax threshold, then, you know, they would have probably gained as much. And it would have certainly applied to a wider group.
Yeah, well, look, national insurance was introduced by Labour. And the idea really was that you pay a little bit out of your wages every week. And that makes sure it pays for things like the National Health Service. It pays for the welfare state, basically. It pays for unemployment benefit if you find yourself out of work. But what they're saying is this is totally outdated. And actually, this money just goes into the same big pot, which is used to pay all the usual things that the government spends money on. So what do you make of it? Because it almost seems to me, Chris, as if this is an attempt to say, well, national insurance has had its day.
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, it always has been a bit of a confidence trick, really, because, I mean, as I've said, taxation and national insurance doesn't pay for public spending. I mean, that's not how it works. You know, when that money's paid in, it's effectively dead money, you know, it's destroyed. And the government, because it issues the currency, it kind of spends it into existence. I mean, tax doesn't fund your public services in that sense. It's not used for that purpose. It's used to control inflation, to drive behavior change, to give a value, you know, for the currency, to create, you know, fiscal space for the government to invest in priorities. Were we in a situation where the government was prepared to, you know, invest in our infrastructure properly and our public services and so on? So I do think that, you know, the whole tax system does need a complete refresh, a complete a revisit, and we need to reform it, I think, from top to bottom. But we're nowhere near that at the moment, because they're all the politicians on both sides of the chamber are just engaged in this confidence trick about taxpayers' money. And, we can't afford a good society because we can't raise tax revenues. There's inadequate tax revenues available, blah, blah, blah. It kind of gives the impression that somehow the billionaires are needed to fund a good society. And, you know, when the likes of Alan Sugar was saying that he was going to leave the country if Jeremy Corbyn got elected, you know, some people were panicking, thinking, oh, well, then all these entrepreneurs will leave, but we don't need them. And that's not how that system works. And frankly, they wouldn't leave in any event, I don't think, because, you know, they get a lot of benefit from living in a secure country with a lifestyle that, you know.
Well, I seem to remember the comedian Mark Thomas offering to drive them to the airport if they want.
Well, I did too. I mean, I said that myself, actually. I went public and said I was more than happy to drive our chauffeur, Lord Sugar, to the airport. Absolutely. I'm sure other people, you know, made the same remark that you say.
Okay. Well, also another thing in the budget is this non-dom tax status. The Chancellor's confirmed it will be abolished and replaced by a modern, simpler and fairer system, he says, from April 2025. So this is for money that people make abroad. The British taxpayer will now start to be not quite sure how much, but there will be tax on this money now, as if it's earnings that were made here in Britain, which, you know, obviously affects Rishi Sunak's own family, particularly his wife. But what do you think this makes much of a difference, this one?
Don't make much of a difference. I mean, I do think measures like that are important, though. I mean, as I say, not to raise the revenue needed to spend into the economy, because that's, as I've already said, doesn't work like that. But, you know, tax is important in circumstances like that to start to address inequality. I mean, inequality has kind of exploded over the last 40-odd years since we embraced neoliberal economics when, as I say, really after Gordon Brown, Dennis Healey went to the International Monetary Fund in 1976. I mean, that was the first monetarist neoliberal government. Margaret Thatcher turbocharged it. Then Blair sort of carried on where she left off, and Gordon Brown did likewise. And then Cameron and Theresa May and, you know, our friend Johnson and Rishi Sunak. I mean, they're all kind of singing from the same hymn shoot, really. There is no discernible difference between Labour and the Conservatives in reality in terms of their economic agenda, just as there's no real difference in terms of their international policy either. You know, they're both wedded to neoliberal economics and they're both in the pockets of the war machine. And that's why I think, you know, we need a fresh start. And this is something I think that the Workers' Party is offering. And that's why George Galloway, you know, won with such a convincing majority in Rochdale in the by-election last week. And, you know, we hope that we will be able to see other breakthroughs with the Workers' Party and potentially other independent candidates which are being selected and different constituencies. So I think Labour will pay a price for the stance that it's taken in support of war, in support of the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza, and it's a pathetic economic agenda. I mean, they're not offering any difference to the Tories in terms of, you know, the big ticket issues like bringing the utilities into public ownership or the railways. All that's just, you know, off the table now. Although one thing that Rachel Reeves did announce a couple of weeks ago is that, you know, there will be no cap on bankers' bonuses. So, I mean, Labour used to traditionally be a party that was concerned about, income inequality, financial inequality. And obviously that is no longer the case now. So, you know.
Okay, look, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, which is sort of basic stuff that people on the street are talking about, Chris. So one is about disposable income. What would the Workers' Party do? Lots of businesses, particularly customer shop facing retail type businesses, are saying people just don't have the money in their pockets to spend with us anymore. We've seen record bankruptcies in 2023 of small businesses. I mean, literally, since World War II, it's never been a situation where so many small businesses have been going bankrupt. It's quite clear that with the hikes in people's rents, their mortgage repayments, electricity, fuel prices, etc., that people just don't have that disposable income anymore. So how are you going to put that back in people's pockets?
Well, we'd have a proper industrial strategy for a start. We would have a strategy to invest in public services, to invest in housing, start building council houses again, training up people to those skills needed to, you know, to build, stop the offshoring of jobs to low wage economies. I mean, when I left school in the city where I live in Derby, there were 120,000 people in manufacturing jobs, you know, good, well paid, skilled and semi skilled jobs. And that they no longer exist. I mean, we've got about 12 or 13, 15,000 maybe people working in that sector now. You know, we've turned very much to the service sector, low wage, low status, precarious employment. So we would want to bring some security back into people's working lives, give people a chance for a proper career, invest in education and give people access to higher education free of charge, of course, rather than actually forcing
but how is that going to actually cut people's mortgage bills? How's that going to cut people's rent?
Well, I mean,
how is that going to cut electricity bills, the gas bills, which have many of which have doubled and more?
Of course. Well, one of the ways in which we do that is by bringing the utilities back into public ownership and controlling the amount that the energy prices can go up by. If you think about it, when there was this big hike in the cost of gas, the wholesale prices of gas, we saw a massive increase in the bills for people in this country, but they were capped, I believe, at 4% increase in France. So the things that obviously can be done. And I saw some figures the other day suggesting that British Gas, for example, had made a ninefold, I think it's now something like a 953% increase in their profit margin, where you've got 42%, I think it is, of the British households who are really struggling to pay their fuel bills. So by bringing the utilities into public ownership, controlling the costs that people have to pay for their energy bills, I mean, we would be obviously bringing people's energy bills down. And by doing that,
you've got a major problem, dividends though, Chris. Chris, you've got a major problem. How are you going to afford to buy all these industries back off the private companies that now control them?
Well, as I've already said, I mean, money is literally no object for a government that issues its own currency. But I think, you would have to have a fair valuation for the particular utility that you were purchasing. And I just think back to the early post-war period when Britain really was broke, and it had just gone through 6 years of a world war. Their debt to GDP ratio, I think, was over 250%. And it was at that point in time a currency that was linked to gold, so there were restrictions in the way in which do not apply now, but they were able to bring back full employment. They set in train a post-war consensus that saw inequality, income inequality, narrowing every single year right the way through to the mid-1970s. In fact, till Dennis Healey went to the International Monetary Fund. Excuse me, they built up, I think, 1 million homes in that 6 year period that Labour were in government. Then they created the welfare state. They introduced the National Health Service. A National Health Service where everything was free. I mean, the founder of the National Health Service, the guy who pioneered it, Anaren Bevan, he resigned when there was a plan to, which was introduced actually, some modest charges brought in for prescriptions. And, he said, once you break that principle, it's a very slippery slope. He was absolutely right. But he and Harold Wilson resigned from the government in protest at that decision. So what I'm saying is it's down to political will and having a political vision. They had that will and they had that vision. And they made a massive change, which impacted on, countless generations actually thereafter. It's been going in the opposite direction ever since.
It has. I mean, look, you've got another major problem if you want to tax the rich, Chris, and that is that most of their money is offshore. This was all allowed after Margaret Thatcher got rid of exchange controls and David Cameron's father set up the first big business, which was helping people take their money offshore so it couldn't be taxed. You can't tax the rich, really, can you? Because it's all offshore.
Well, I mean, I think there are things that can be done. And indeed, this is something that Jeremy Corbyn was talking about. Certainly in those British dependencies, which are tax havens, there are, powers that the British Exchequer could bring to bear. But I think the reason why you'd be wanting to do that is to say it's not to raise revenue to spend, but this is about, dealing with inequality. Also, the huge power that, the super rich have. Is also damaging to democracy and democratic accountability. And that's why I think, you need to use the tax regime to address those sorts of things. The naked obvious inequality, but also the power that goes with it. I mean, look at the likes of Rupert Murdoch and the power that he wields over governments, not just in this country, but around the world, if you could use the tax system, to clobber these people a bit more, then, they would not have the power. They would not be able to undermine democracy in the way in which they've done. They would not. Because if you think about it, a lot of the problems that people are experiencing now in this country are really down to the decisions that are taken by these faceless super rich corporations and these anonymous people in boardrooms.
Who also, by the way, many of them, like the Daily Mail, etc., they have all their wealth offshore. It's not an easy nut to crack, is it? Anyway, look, listen, if you were sitting in Jeremy Hunt's seat, not that I can't really imagine that actually, Chris, but if you were, what would be your maybe two or three main planks you'd be announcing today in the budget?
Well, I'd be announcing a plan to eliminate poverty in the lifetime of a parliament, although we're nearly at the end of this parliament. But certainly that's something I think that we could be doing. So I think there would be a big increase in the social security budget in order to alleviate the grotesque levels of poverty that we have in this country. I would also be announcing a big public housing drive to address the the housing crisis that we have in the country, you know, people sleeping rough and people living in insanitary accommodation and so on. And it'd also be announcing a big increase in the minimum wage as well to go alongside the increase in social security payments. I think they would be the kind of things that would make a huge difference to people. And if you wanted me to go on, I would be, you know, bringing in measures to restrict the ability of the utilities to charge the fees that they do, and also start set in train the process to bring these utilities and rail industry, etc., back into public ownership. Essentially, what we need to do is put the state at the centre of creating a good society. The states have enormous powers at their disposal. And particularly in Britain, because of status as a currency issuing nation, unlike in Europe, of course, where they've gone into the eurozone. And so, in essentially, what the nations of the that are in the eurozone in the European Union, they've been relegated to the status of a local authority, where they're not in control of their own destiny, you know, and because they can't issue their own currency anymore. That was one good thing that Gordon Brown did when he kept us out of the euro. So, but I think that'd be my three sort of top priorities. But there's so much wrong with the country. God, you know, you could go on all night to say, well,
you certainly could. I was also going to ask you about Birmingham and about the bankruptcies in local government. Yeah, what would you, as Chancellor, do about that? Could you do?
Well, I mean, I think what they could already do right now, there are powers available to local authorities. And this was something that I was arguing for when I was on the front bench when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader. And indeed, this was the reason I resigned from the front bench, because there was a pushback against the idea that I was putting forward from the local government front bench. I was in the home shadow home office team responsible for fire and emergency services, was my portfolio area. But I put forward a proposition after I'd been lobbied by local people in my hometown who were concerned about a Labour authority making cuts and closing libraries, etc. And they were asking what I was going to do about it. And obviously, as the MP, you don't have any direct influence over or control over the local authority. So anyway, we put our thinking caps on, me and my team, and we came up with this idea that was made possible by the 2012 Local Government Finance Act, which introduced the concept of differential council tax discounts. So that gives the local authorities the ability to offer differing discounts to households in different council tax bands. And so in Derby's case, I was suggesting what we could do is double the council tax for the richest people in the borough, those living in the Band H properties, and then we would double it for everybody, but then they would discount it back. So they would pay the full whack. Then the people in the Band G dwellings, the proposition for Derby was that we would give them a 20% reduction. So they'd have an 80% increase. And then for Band F, you know, it would be a 100% increase, but the 40% reduction down to, regrettably, in Derby's case, it would have meant bringing in Band D dwellings, which would have ended up with a 20% increase in their council tax. But 85% of the households in Derby live in bands A to C, and we could have frozen council tax for those households. And we could have, on that basis, and this is going back to 2018, 2017, 2018, we could have stopped the Tory cuts and built in some growth. I think it would have given us the flexibility to have about £10 million worth of growth. And I was arguing that what you need to do is go out to the community and say, well, this is what we can do. You'd have to go to a referendum, because the Secretary of State stipulates that how much local authorities are allowed to increase their council tax by each year. They can exceed that, but if they do exceed that, they have to go to a referendum and get approval from the local people. And so I was saying, well, go to the people and say, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to ask the rich people in the borough to pay for this proposition to stop the cuts and build in some growth. But the point is that this idea could be applied, you know, all over the country, depending on how many properties you've got in the higher bands and so on. And so some local authority has, and I did speak to a number of Labour groups, and they were some of them close to embracing this idea. They've got, I mean, some of the London boroughs, they were telling me they had thousands of properties in bands H and G and F and so on. So they were talking about the potential to even reduce council tax for most of the households and stop the cuts and build in some growth. So that was the sort of thing I was saying. But those that I mean, most ignored it. Most didn't go anywhere near it. Those that did were, it's, I mean, the notion of municipal socialism is long gone, and this sense of using the powers at your disposal, they just seemed too timid about that. And the only way in which they were prepared to proceed was if they'd been given the green light, or were told to do that, or encouraged to do that by the Labour leadership in the House of Commons. And I was saying to them, well, why do you need permission from leadership in Parliament? This is the law of the land. It's been made possible by Eric Pickles, of all people. You know, you've got executive power as leaders of local, if your local authority, and you can stop the cuts and you can build in great. Yes, you'll have to go to a consultation and a referendum with the local people in your locality. But if you can't win a referendum on that basis, I mean, you know, you shouldn't really be in politics.
Well, and then there's also quite a lot of cap doffing going on there, Chris.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, the notion of municipal socialism, which was a thing, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. I mean, it was local authorities that really took on Thatcher and were a great bulwark against the massive cuts that the Tory government were bringing about. And, you know, Labour local authorities did a hell of a lot to protect people. You know, think what the Greater London Council did, some of the initiatives that they put in place. I'm thinking of my own local area in Derbyshire County Council. Leader of the council then was a chap called David Bookbinder. We used to call him Bookie. He sadly passed away a few months ago, but a really great innovative council leader, doing some amazing stuff, you know, pioneering community education, fantastic services for disabled people. Derbyshire had such a great reputation that disabled people were moving to Derbyshire from all over the country because of the quality of the services that were being provided there, you know. And, I mean, there's a great little documentary you can still get talking about the Clay Cross rent rebels back in 1972 to 73, I think it was. Ted Heath's government was insisting that local authorities substantially increase council house rents. Now, a lot of Labour authorities said they weren't going to do that, but then they all fell in line in the end. Clay Cross was left on its own, but they refused to do that. But the documentary talks about that struggle that they had because they got surcharged and bankrupted and were banned from office, and then a new lot came in and they did the same, and they were surcharged and banned, bankrupted and banned from office. But the documentary talks about that struggle with the government, and how they mobilised the community against that. But it also talks about lots of other things that they were doing, innovative things. I mean, it was Clay Cross Council back in the day, about 20 odd years before the Labour government under Blair brought in free TV licences for pensioners. Clay Cross Council were doing it, you know, in the early 1970s. And when Margaret Thatcher, when she was Secretary of State for Education, she earned the sobriquet back then as Margaret Thatcher Milk Snatcher. She took away the school milk for the kids. Clay Cross found a way of raising the resources through innovative use of the regulations at their disposal to find a way to raise the revenue to make sure they could continue to provide the school milk. That's municipal socialism in action. That's actually, you know, using your political platform, using your political power to make a difference for your class, to make a difference for the people that elect you. And I just so regret to say that now, in my experience in local government, they're just kind of bureaucrats, managerial, this kind of managerial mindset.
And even the poorest in Birmingham, and of course the council tax falls on the individual, not the homeowner, are now going to be paying 21% more council tax. One does wonder if it is feasible for central government, and Rishi Sunak is a Goldman Sachs man, he should be able to know about raising money, could actually be paying for this. But no, apparently this is all going to fall on the heads of local people in Birmingham. 21% increase in council tax, as well as all the other things that they're having to cope with in the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, so it's a double whammy, isn't it? So it's got a massive increase in council tax and cuts in services at the same time. And the sorts of things, the quality of life things, you know, that local authorities used to provide, most of them, if not all of them, have gone now. I mean,
they may even be able to look at, you know, hang on, what we're paying, what we're getting for it is actually far less than what we're paying. So maybe we just don't want to pay it at all. Chris, finally, can I just ask you about your thoughts about the Workers' Party in the general election? Because many people are saying, well, this is just George Galloway. This is a bit of a one-off. You know, the Labour Party backed off, the Green Party backed off. Simon Danchuk really was a bit of a bad candidate as well. So is there any chance that you'll be repeating it? And what are your thoughts about what the end result might be in the general election?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're probably heading towards a Labour government, regrettably, but it won't make much difference, as I've already said, from a Tory government. I'm hoping that we could get to a position where it could be a hung parliament with a Labour minority administration. I don't think that the George Galloway election is necessarily a one-off. I mean, George is a massive figure, obviously, and does have a following in his own right. But, you know, there is a lot of dissatisfaction with Labour Party in particular, because, you know, people, working class people, people from minority communities used to look to the Labour Party as the party that, you know, cared about their interests, put their interests, you know, as a top priority. And because Labour's stance on the war in Gaza, you know, the genocide that Israel's visiting on the people of Gaza and the pogroms that they are mounting in the occupied West Bank and so on, and the fact that the Labour Party is totally in the pocket of the Israeli regime has really angered, you know, huge swathes of the country, but particularly in the Muslim community. And this is the Muslim Vote campaign, which is looking to organise Muslims in the country in different constituencies to put forward candidates or get behind alternative independent candidates or workers' party candidates, maybe. I've spoken to people in other constituencies that are currently held by the Conservatives that the Labour Party would expect to win, and certainly did win under the Blair era, that they recognise it's probably a bridge too far to expect to be able to, as independent candidates, or even if, you know, get behind a workers' party candidate, say, probably a bridge too far to maybe think that we could win that. I mean, nothing's impossible, I suppose, but, you know, they are not saying they want to field candidates in order to win. They want to field candidates to stop Labour taking those seats. Because although they recognise that will almost certainly mean that the Tories will still hang on, they want to make the Labour Party pay a price for their betrayal. And, you know, given that there's very little difference to choose between Labour and the Tories in terms of economic policy and foreign policy, it's a hit that people are prepared to take. Because, you know, if there is no sanction on the Labour Party for their betrayal, then, you know, there's no incentive for them to change their position. Although my own view is that I think the Labour Party is beyond redemption now. Our best bet is to destroy the Labour Party as best we can and create a new vehicle. And that's what we hope maybe the Workers' Party could potentially be that new vehicle, or if not be that vehicle itself, maybe be the catalyst for the new vehicle to emerge. And we are collaborating with various independent campaigns which are springing up in places like Newham, in Ilford and other parts of the country. So we'll have candidates in some areas. We'll be backing and supporting independent candidatures in other areas. The thing we're very keen to try and avoid is any electoral clashes between progressive forces providing an alternative to the main party, to the political duopoly. That's something that we're very keen to try and avoid if at all possible. And I think there is goodwill around to do that. And who knows? You know, I think although the Labour Party is riding high in the opinion polls, there will be, I believe, some surprising results. They're riding high, not because people are particularly keen on Labour's agenda, if people kind of even know what it is, other than it being very similar to what the Tories are. It's because the Tories are so incredibly unpopular. And that's how Labour's gone. Labour's, you know, running high by default. And, you know, when George was able, the Workers' Party were able to provide a credible alternative, people rallied to it in huge numbers, as we saw. I mean, George got more votes than the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Green Party, the Liberal Democrat Party, and the Reform Party put together. It was a huge result. And that gives us great hope. And his victory has given a real impetus to the Workers' Party. We've had huge, I mean, our volunteers, we are, as I say, still a relatively small ACORN. It's actually organised and run by volunteers. And they're kind of, you know, running around like headless chickens trying to keep up with the surge in support. But it's the other thing it's done, of course, is to demonstrate to people who are fed up and are maybe thinking of supporting an alternative to the political duopoly, that there is, you know, it is possible to make that breakthrough. You know, you can break the political duopoly. And so I think that, you know, when there is an alternative candidate, you know, a lot of people who might have otherwise maybe stayed at home will be encouraged to come out and potentially vote, because what we've proved in Rochdale is that, you know, that we can make that breakthrough. And I predict that we will see some. I'm not saying we'll be forming. I'd love to see that we could, you know, form a Workers' Party government. I'm not making that prediction, but I do think that we will get a few independent voices into the House of Commons to provide some real opposition, because there is no opposition in the House of Commons at the moment. It's all theatre. It's all parliamentary parlour games.
Yeah, and I think for many on the left, it's been a terrific morale boost, and it's a poke in the face for the apathetic. Anyway, yes, Chris Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.
Best of luck. Thank you.